Hey everybody, welcome to Morbidology. I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporter, Heather Brown. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on Morbidology. The support on Patreon truly helps out, and I am eternally grateful. Also, as I'm sure you already know by now, I have a new investigative podcast series called The Shattered Window. It covers the case of Jacqueline Wallaby over the course of 10 episodes. We trawled through thousands of files and conducted hours of interviews. Please make sure to subscribe to The Shattered Window wherever you're listening to this episode of Morbidology. I'd also like to remind you that I'm going to be there at CrimeCon in London in June of 2021. They have discounted tickets at the minute, but only until Christmas. It would make the perfect gift for any true crime fan. Head on over to crimecon.co.uk and use promo code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. Hope to see you there, and now on with today's episode. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Carnation is a small town of just under 2,000 people, around 25 miles east of Seattle. It is a sleepy community where ponies and goats can often be spotted grazing along main thoroughfares, and where store clerks know everybody's name. It's the kind of town that people go to live for a quiet and rural lifestyle. As families all across the world were winding down after Christmas of 2007, a grisly crime scene was being unfolded in Carnation, the aftermath of which would completely destroy generations of one family. It was around 5:13 p.m. on Christmas Eve of 2007 when police in Carnation, Washington, received a 911 call from a rural home at 346 Avenue Northeast. There was nobody on the other end of the line. The 911 operator heard yelling in the background, but said that it sounded like there was some kind of party going on. The phone call cut off after 10 seconds, and the 911 operator attempted to call back twice, but those calls went straight to voicemail. Around 30 minutes later, police arrived at the property. They found that the gate in front of the long drive leading up to the home was locked. Instead of proceeding further, police just turned around and made no attempt to get into the home or to conduct a welfare check. The home where the phone call had come from belonged to 60-year-old Wayne Anderson and his wife, 61-year-old Judy Anderson. The home was quite rural and was situated at the end of a long dirt road. Wayne was a veteran Boeing engineer who was looking forward to his retirement, while Judy worked as a mail carrier for the U.S. Postal Service. It was a job that Judy loved. She was extremely social and became to know most of the people along her route. She would always go that extra mile. For example, if somebody was sick, Judy would always bring the mail to their front door instead of leaving it at the mailbox. Judy was also an avid gardener and grew her own apples, raspberries, and tomatoes. The couple had three children, 32-year-old Scott, 29-year-old Michelle, and Mary, who was the eldest. As Judy's co-worker, Jan Hollenbeck, said, she was close to all her kids. They were everything to her. Scott lived in Black Diamond with his wife, Erica, and their two children, 6-year-old Olivia and 3-year-old Nathan. He worked in construction and enjoyed painting cars as a sideline. As his neighbour, Mike Gould, said, Scott was a friendly guy. He worked in C&Rs, and when he wasn't working, he was devoted to his family. Erica was a stay-at-home mother who doted on her two children. Neighbours recollected that you could often see Olivia, Nathan, and Erica playing in the garden, and Nathan in particular loved waving at the neighbours. Scott and Erica met when they were at Tolt High School together and were high school sweethearts. Mary lived in North Bend and was extremely close with her mother, Judy, with whom she shared a passion for gardening. Judy had hoped that she could train Mary to take over the postal job that she had held for over 17 years. As one friend said, they were almost inseparable. They talked on the phone 3 or 4 times a day. Wayne and Judy had lived in the home since the early 1980s and later purchased the adjacent property, where they placed a mobile home for Michelle and her 29-year-old boyfriend, Joseph McEnroe, to live in. Michelle had been living in Glendale, Arizona, when she met Joseph online, around 5 years earlier. Shortly after they met, Joseph moved in with Michelle. Joseph was a talented artist but bounced between menial jobs. He worked as a store clerk in Target while Michelle was unemployed. At around 8 a.m. on Boxing Day, one of Judy's co-workers, Linda Teal, made her way to the family's home when Judy didn't arrive for her shift at the postal service. This was completely out of character for Judy. She was extremely punctual and reliable, and she knew that the Christmas period was one of the busiest of the year. Linda spoke with Crime Watch Daily about what happened next.
And so I opened the door a little bit and I yelled, Judy, it's Linda. And there's no response. And so I opened the door farther and lean in and yell, Judy, it's Linda, we're worried about you. I look down and I can see a man is laying on the ground.
When she called out Judy's name, she received no reply. As she glanced towards the living room, she saw the lifeless body of a man. At first, she worried that he had passed out due to carbon monoxide poisoning. However, as she approached the body, she noticed that he was surrounded in blood and had sustained a gunshot wound to the face. Linda proceeded throughout the house and found 5 more bodies. Linda grabbed the landline and called 911.
911?
There's been a murder. There's 3 people dead that I can see right now.
Inside?
I just came up. She works with me.
Inside a house?
Yes.
What do you see?
There's a baby and a man and a woman, and she's my best friend.
The bodies would be identified as Wayne and Judy, as well as the bodies of their son, Scott, his wife, Erica, and their 2 children, 6-year-old Olivia and 3-year-old Nathan. All of the victims had been shot dead. As investigators were cordoning off the crime scene and removing the bodies, Michelle and her boyfriend, Joseph, appeared. While the home was swarming with investigators and it was evident that this was an active crime scene, neither Michelle or Joseph asked what was going on, what had happened, or whether Michelle's family were okay. This, of course, was extremely suspicious to investigators, who arrested them both and brought them down to police headquarters for an interview. Here, they both confessed that they had been the ones to commit the massacre.
We've arrested two people in this multiple homicide, a man and a woman, both in their late 20s. We still don't have a motive as such, but the suspects are known to the victims.
When it was publicly released that a 911 call had come from inside the home, and police visited the home but turned around after finding the gate locked. Understandably, there were a lot of questions. King County Sheriff Sergeant John Urquhart said, "They didn't go past it. I don't know why yet. It's one of the things we're looking into." Investigators had not yet established a sequence of events, but believed that the 911 call had come near the end of the slayings. The department's police requires deputies to determine who made the 911 call, and Sergeant Urquhart said that he was unsure as to why this was not done in this case, and it was another thing that they would be investigating. He further hinted that the motive was a long-standing dispute between Michelle and her parents, but he refused to elaborate any further. The arrest came as a massive surprise, especially to Joseph's family. His mother, Sean Johnson, of Minneapolis, said that her son was a good Christian, and she couldn't understand what had caused him to snap. She said that Joseph hated firearms and would even shun toy guns. Furthermore, she said that he hadn't ever been in trouble with the law before and hadn't had so much as a speeding ticket. She said, "He's always been kind. He wouldn't hurt a fly. It's surreal." However, she did admit that she hadn't had much contact with her son since he cut ties with his family after a dispute over money. In fact, Sean believed that Michelle was the cause of the rift in their relationship. She said that she had never met Michelle in person and had only spoken to her several times over the phone, but she always came across as distant. Speaking with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, she said, "He said he loved her and that he planned on getting married." The first thing that investigators wanted to determine was the sequence of events that led to the slayings. Investigators went to the Black Diamond neighborhood of Scott and his family to determine when they had last been seen. According to their neighbors, they had left on Christmas Eve to drive to Carnation to visit the family for Christmas. It still wasn't known who had been murdered first or whether the family had been tied up and systematically killed or what had unfolded in the home. Michelle and Joseph were both charged with 6 counts of aggravating first-degree murder. During a press conference, prosecutor Dan Statterberg said that given the magnitude of the crime, they would most likely be seeking the death penalty if Michelle and Joseph were found guilty. He said that while long-standing bitterness and a perceived family debt may have been factors in the murders, the motive for the slayings may never be known. He said, "In the end, what motive could you find that would make sense of the senseless slaying of the Anderson family?" According to court documents, Michelle and Joseph readily admitted their role in the murders. Michelle said that they both shot and killed her parents, her brother, and her sister-in-law, but said that it was Joseph who killed the children. They admitted that on Christmas Eve, they both armed themselves with handguns and entered Wayne and Judy's home. They said that they confronted Michelle's parents in the living room and shot them both dead. Michelle had told investigators that Scott had owed her money that she allegedly lent to him years earlier, and that she had been upset with her parents when they didn't take her side. She also told investigators that her parents had been asking her to pay rent for living on their property. The court documents read in part, "Michelle stated that she was tired of everybody stepping on her. She stated that she was upset with her parents and her brother, and that if the problems did not get resolved on December 24, then her intent was to definitely kill everybody." Wayne was the first in the family to be killed. Michelle had confessed that when they entered her parents' home, Judy was wrapping Christmas presents in the back room, while Wayne was relaxing in the living room, waiting for his family to arrive to celebrate Christmas. Michelle said, that she approached her father and aimed the gun at his head. She pulled the trigger and missed. This was when Joseph stepped in and leveled his gun and shot Wayne once in the head. As the shot rang out in the home, Judy ran to the living room from the back room. As her eyes transfixed to the body of her husband on the floor, Joseph raised the gun to her and pulled the trigger. Judy fell to the ground but was still alive. Joseph approached Judy, apologized, and then shot her again, this time in the head. Michelle and Joseph then dragged the two bodies to a shed that was located behind the house. They used towels and rugs to soak up the blood in the living room so that when Scott and his family arrived, they wouldn't notice that anything was amiss. Once the family were inside, Michelle pulled out the gun. Attempting to defend his family, Scott charged at Michelle and was shot 4 times. Michelle then turned the gun on Erica and shot her 2 times. Unbeknownst to Michelle and Joseph, Erica was still clinging to life. She was able to crawl behind the sofa where she placed the 911 call. Upon noticing that Erica was still alive and on the phone, Joseph grabbed the phone from her hands and smashed it. Erica was cowering behind the sofa with Olivia and Nathan. She pleaded with Joseph, saying, "You don't have to do this." Joseph responded with, "Yes, we do," before firing a final shot at Erica's head. Joseph then apologized to Olivia before shooting her once in the head, and then turning to apologize to Nathan. Nathan, who was just 3 years old, had picked up the batteries from the cordless phone that Erica had used to try and call for help. Joseph shot Nathan once in the head. When investigators had asked Joseph why he killed Erica, Olivia, and Nathan, if the motivation was Michelle's anger at her family, he said that he was afraid that they would turn them in. Following the shootings, Michelle and Joseph started driving north towards Canada, before driving south towards Oregon. However, as they drove around, they decided that they would return home and pretend to discover the bodies, anticipating that this would make them look less guilty. Following the release of the court documents, King County Sheriffs Sue Rare called for an internal investigation of the response by the 2 police officers to the 911 call. Sheriff Rare said that all 6 of the victims were already dead before the time the 2 police officers arrived, but said that they still needed to know if correct procedures were followed, and if not, she wanted to uncover why. With the investigation underway, the Seattle Times briefly spoke with Joseph over the phone while he was in jail. He said that he'd been placed on suicide watch and said that he was struggling behind bars. Speaking about the victims, he said, "I'm sorry that they're gone. They were my family too, you know. I hope wherever they're at, they're at peace. That's all I'm going to say about them." They asked about his family, and Joseph said that the murders had made him realize how much he missed his own family. He said, "It's easy enough to think that they don't like you or don't care about you, but I wish to God I got in touch with them before this. I would have even been able to visit them. I guess that's not going to happen now." In the days immediately after the shootings, more information regarding Michelle and Joseph leaked into the public. They had moved into the trailer on Wayne and Judy's property around 3 years earlier. According to those who lived in the area, as soon as they moved in, they covered the windows with black garbage bags. Shortly thereafter, they put up a chicken wire fence to keep their neighbor's son from crossing an imaginary line between their home and their trailer. Stephanie Ammons, who lived across the street, said they had a phobia of anyone coming in their yard. If your cat walked on their driveway or your kids rolled a ball on their lawn, they would freak out. Other people in the neighborhood said that Michelle and Joseph came across as deeply paranoid. Some said that they could often be heard yelling and that they frequently lodged complaints over the most minor offenses, and often waited until the middle of the night to take their garbage out, so that they would not see anybody. One neighbour, Carissa McGee, said that Joseph in particular never spoke to anybody and never made any eye contact. She also said that it was evident to her that Michelle was the more dominant one in the relationship. She said that if she ever asked Joseph a question, he would look to Michelle to answer. Over time, however, she said that Michelle kind of came out of her shell and engaged in several conversations. She said that Michelle and Joseph seemed to always be complaining about their lack of money, yet neither could hold down a steady job. The description of Michelle from her neighbours varied substantially from the description of Michelle that former classmates at Cedar Crest High School recalled. Those who attended the high school with Michelle said that she was a very talented artist who won an art award as a sophomore and competed on the cross-country team. Several people said that while in school, Michelle was one of the more normal people and they couldn't understand what had happened over the last 12 years to cause her to commit one of the most heinous murders the area had ever seen. According to Jennifer Chandler, who went to school with Michelle, she'd gone to Michelle's trailer around a year beforehand and had been surprised to hear that she was suffering from depression and anxiety. Michelle told Jennifer that she had been on medication for a while, but couldn't afford to stay on it. The community of Carnation really struggled in the wake of the murders. As I mentioned earlier, it's a very quaint community, where essentially everybody knows one another. Judy in particular was well known in the area. Paulette Jacklin, who Judy delivered newspapers to, spoke with the Seattle Times and said that she had only gotten a few hours of sleep since the bodies were discovered. She emotionally stated, "Every time I lay down and close my eyes, her face is the first face in my head." As a way to try and cope and begin the healing process, locals started a makeshift memorial on the driveway leading to Wayne and Judy's home. By Saturday afternoon, there were more than a dozen flower arrangements, cards and balloons piled up. While Wayne and Judy and the rest of the family were not members of the Tolt Congregational United Church of Christ, during the New Year's Eve service, Reverend Stephen Haddon intoned their names and lit white candles lined up on the altar. Six candles were lit for the six members of the family who had been slain while the bell chimed. There were two candles that remained on the altar. The Reverend lit those candles, but the chimes fell silent as he prayed for the two final names, Michelle and Joseph. He encouraged the congregation to share their feelings about the murders and to remember that the community abounds with generosity. Following the service, Reverend Haddon said that it was difficult for him to pray for Michelle and Joseph, while others in attendance shared their fond memories of the family, especially Judy, who everybody knew the most. The following evening, another candlelight vigil was held on the lawn near Carnation City Hall. Mary, the other daughter of Wayne and Judy, attended the vigil. She was held tightly by friends and family as her tears flowed. On the 9th of January, Michelle and Joseph appeared in court where they both pleaded not guilty to the murders. Family members and friends wept in the courtroom as the charges were read out. Some of them wore pins bearing the pictures of Nathan and Olivia. King County Prosecutor Dan Statterberg had 30 days to decide whether he would be seeking the death penalty against the couple. If they decided to seek the death penalty, that would mean that Michelle would be the first woman to face the death penalty in King County. Ben Anderson, who was the son of Mary and the grandson of Wayne and Judy, said, "I personally would rather see them sit in jail the rest of their lives than be executed. I think the death penalty is just an easy way out." The following week, hundreds of family members, friends and acquaintances packed into Eastbridge Christian Assembly for the funeral of Wayne, Judy, Scott, Erica, Olivia, and Nathan. Tears flowed throughout the church as eulogies were read out for each of the victims, as a slideshow depicting their lives were played in the background. Pictures of the victims were placed at the front of the church and surrounded in flower arrangements. A number of those who knew the family fondly recalled memories. Lori Cleaver, who was the postmaster of Carnation, presented the surviving Anderson family members with the U.S. flag, which had been flown at half staff over the post office since the shootings. Speaking about Judy, she said, "Judy watched schoolchildren grow into adulthood. She was always aware of births and weddings." Dixon Dabble, who was one of Wayne's colleagues, recollected how Wayne always brought in fresh-baked zucchini bread, and he likened him to an M&M, stating that he was rough on the outside, but warm and friendly on the inside. One of Erica's close friends, Carrie Horner, said that she was the most selfless and loving mother she had ever met, and she always put her family before anything else. A friend of Scott became too overcome with emotion to speak, so Pastor Andy Rois called him an honest and hard-working man. Pastor Dan Meter told the mourners how Olivia had just learned to read, and that Nathan loved cars, hot dogs, cookies, and playing with his sister. Ben said that he could not have asked for better grandparents than Wayne and Judy. As he wiped a tear from his cheek, he said, "They will be my friends for the rest of my life. And I will say, I'm proud to be an Anderson." Shortly after the funeral, Prosecutor Satterberg agreed to postpone his decision on seeking the death penalty against Michelle and Joseph. The delay gave their defense attorneys more time to provide information about their clients and mitigating evidence. Then in May, King County Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Ramstall ordered that Michelle undergo a psychiatric evaluation to determine whether she was mentally fit to stand trial. He ordered that two mental health professionals, one hired by the prosecution and one hired by the defense, would evaluate Michelle. While the prosecution were still deciding on whether or not they would be seeking the death penalty, there was a bizarre twist when Michelle called a local television station from jail, confessing to the murders once again and demanding that she be sentenced to death. She said that she had wanted to plead guilty during the arraignment, but her defense attorneys would not allow her. According to Michelle, she was sorry for killing her family, but said that she snapped after years of physical and emotional abuse. She said that the money dispute was just a symptom and that her rage had grown steadily over the years of family conflict. She also said, "I've been assessed by three different mental health specialists, and they've all said I'm sane and competent." Michelle's claims upset and angered the surviving members of the Anderson family. Ben said that he had never seen anything that could bolster Michelle's claims of long-withstanding abuse and mistreatment. A number of other people came forward and said that Wayne and Judy had tried their hardest to help their youngest daughter over the years, and even let her live on their property rent-free. The following month, Judge Jeffrey Ramstall said that there had been a breakdown in communication between Michelle and her lawyers, and agreed to remove them. In October, Prosecutor Satterberg announced that he would be seeking the death penalty against both Michelle and Joseph, and that he had made the decision based on the magnitude of the murders. It was only the second time that King County had pursued the death penalty since it was sought for the Green River killer, Gary Ridgway. Ultimately, in that case, prosecutors would opt against capital punishment in exchange for his cooperation. While Michelle had said that she wanted the death penalty, her new defense attorney, Stephen Ille, said that he would be fighting to save her life. He acknowledged that Michelle had told the media that she was guilty and wanted to be executed, but said that she had changed her mind after he and her second defense attorney, Lisa Mulligan took over the case. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you, and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Shortly after the one-year anniversary to the slayings, it was announced that the murder trial would likely not be occurring until 2010, due to the complexity of the case. In October, Michelle appeared in court for a pre-trial hearing, during which she went on a diatribe against her defense attorneys and referred to them as dishonest and unqualified. She asked the judge to appoint new defense attorneys and also asked for the charges against Joseph to be dropped, claiming that she had acted alone. She then asked prosecutor James Connaught to charge her with kidnapping for forcing Joseph to participate in the murders. The prosecutor informed Michelle that he would not be dropping the charges against Joseph and would not be amending her charges. The judge was subsequently turned down Michelle's request for new defense attorneys. Under state law, a prosecutor can file an aggravated murder charge only if the defendant commits premeditated first-degree murder and one or more aggravating circumstances exist. As the two-year anniversary to the murders were approaching, Michelle and Joseph's defense lawyers attempted to argue that the death penalty in their case was unconstitutional. Catherine Ross, Joseph's defense attorney, told the judge that the state's aggravated murder statute is unconstitutional because the list of aggravating factors was far too broad, which meant that too many people were eligible for the death penalty. King County Senior Deputy Prosecutor Andrew Vitalich argued back that even if the list was long, Michelle and Joseph could still face the death penalty because the aggravating factors cited in their case, which was multiple victims killed in a common scheme, had been on the list of aggravating factors since 1975, when the death penalty was reinstated. The judge would side with the prosecution and decide that they could seek the death penalty. It was then decided that Michelle and Joseph would be standing trial separately, and the trial dates were pushed back until October of 2011. In November, there was another setback when it was revealed that Lisa Mulligan, one of Michelle's defense attorneys, had stolen a bloody envelope from the crime scene in Carnation. She admitted that she had lifted what she claimed was an empty envelope from the floor on the crime scene. The prosecution speculated that the decision to tell the court of the incident was a move aimed at getting Michelle's defense attorneys removed from the case. The judge said that the defense attorney's interests were now in conflict with those of her client and ordered her to withdraw from the case. This meant that the case would be pushed back even further. Then a couple of months later, a judge ordered another mental evaluation of Michelle, while prosecutor James Connaught was removed from the case over allegations he had used racially charged comments in an unrelated trial. Michelle would once again be deemed mentally competent to stand trial, despite the fact that her new defense attorney, Colleen O'Connor, said that she was highly emotional and unable to assist in her defense. It had been 4.5 long years since the murders had been committed, and the case was moving through the justice system at a snail's pace. By this point in the case, $4.9 million had been spent preparing for the trials. It was the highest amount spent in preparing for a potential death penalty case in King County since the prosecution of Gary Ridgway. With the Ridgway case, the total spend would be almost $12 million. When it comes to a death penalty case, a lot more care needs to be taken to make sure that any decisions are accurate and that an innocent person is not sentenced to death. Furthermore, defense lawyers in capital cases tend to be more expensive because they are more experienced, and a full historical profile of death penalty defendants needs to be completed. It was decided that Joseph would be standing trial first, and his trial was scheduled for January of 2013. But then when January rolled around, Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Ramsdell ruled that the state could not seek the death penalty against Michelle or Joseph. He said that the prosecutor's office had made a mistake in considering the strength of its evidence in deciding to seek the death penalty. He said that considering the strength of the evidence used to prove guilt cannot be applied to the decision to seek the death penalty because it violates equal protection under the law. Because of this, the case was once again pushed back. The decision was lambasted not only by the prosecution and the family, but by many locals as well. A lot of people accused the judge of judicial activism. The prosecution responded by saying that they would be seeking an emergency appeals court review and accused the judge of being simply wrong. The case was handed to the state Supreme Court, who ruled that the prosecution could seek the death penalty against the defendants. They unanimously decided that the judge was wrong to bar the prosecution from pursuing capital punishment. By this point in the case, $7 million had been spent, and it was estimated to rise much higher. In January of 2014, Joseph attempted to plead guilty to the murders in a bid to avoid a death sentence. In a lengthy statement, he admitted to the murders, although he pleaded guilty to non-capital aggravated murder, which is a crime not listed in state law. King County Senior Deputy Prosecutor Scott O'Toole lambasted Joseph, saying, "Joseph McEnroe is not going to dictate his punishment." The prosecution denied the guilty plea. Finally, in January of 2015, Joseph's murder trial began. During opening statements, King County Superior Deputy Prosecutor Scott O'Toole told the jury that at least 16 rounds were fired inside the family's home. There was no doubt that the people who committed the murders were Michelle and Joseph. He warned the jury that the descriptions of the murders were going to be gruesome and said that nothing could explain the callousness and senselessness of the murders. Defense attorney Leo Hamaji, however, claimed that Joseph was operating under the control of his mentally ill girlfriend, Michelle. He said, "Michelle infected Joe with her paranoid worldview." He said that Michelle exerted influence and control over Joseph, so much so that he couldn't resist her on the day of the murders. He claimed that unlike Michelle, Joseph had not planned the murders. Joseph's defense lawyer essentially admitted that Joseph had committed the murders, but asked the jury to keep an open mind. One of the first witnesses of the trial was Pam Mantle, the mother of Eric and the grandmother of Nathan and Olivia. She told the jury how she loved spoiling her grandchildren and said that they were very much loved and very joyous children. Next to testify was Linda Teal, the co-worker of Judy who found the bodies. She took the jury through the traumatic experience before the 911 call she had placed was played out. She described how she was told to stay in the house with the dead body of her friend and her family, while she waited for police to arrive, so as to not contaminate the crime scene. Linda said she was terrified because she had no idea whether the killer was still in the house or whether they would come back for her. Nevertheless, Linda waited in the house for 32 agonizing minutes, waiting for police to arrive. The 911 call revealed that Linda already suspected that Michelle was involved in the slayings. While on the phone to the operator, she said, "Which makes me wonder if her daughter did it, which is scary, because I might be up here with a murderer." Afterwards, a recorded interview between Joseph and investigators was played out. The recording was from when Joseph was sitting in a patrol vehicle outside the family's home in Carnation after the bodies were discovered. He rambled about his cat, giggled, muttered, and spoke about marrying Michelle in Las Vegas. After more than 90 minutes, the investigator said to Joseph that Michelle had told another investigator an entirely different story and suggested that he tell the truth. Joseph then made a full confession to the murders and said that he had killed Erica and the children because he didn't want them to turn them in. He was eerily calm as he described the murders. Michelle's taped confession was played out afterwards. First of all, Michelle claimed that she and Joseph had been going to Las Vegas to get married. But when asked why they had turned around and showed up at her parents' home, Michelle became confused as she tried to think of an explanation. She claimed she came back for a wallet and fruit. However, Michelle eventually confessed. She initially claimed that Joseph wasn't there and had nothing to do with the murders. However, when she went into detail about the murders, she admitted Joseph's role. At one point, she said, "I shot 4 of those revolver shots into my brother and 2 into Erica and ran out of bullets. Joseph finished off Erica and the kids." Michelle had claimed that she had been abused by her family and that Scott owed her $40,000. However, according to investigators, there was no such evidence of such. She also told investigators that she had freaked out. But as investigators pointed out, that would make sense for 20 seconds, and the murders had taken place over the course of 2 hours. When speaking about the murder of Nathan, who was shot dead while clutching his mother, she said, "Nathan looked like he knew that he was going to die and was accepting it. It was weird." The defense team called on a very unlikely witness during the trial, and that was Mark Mann, Michelle's ex-boyfriend. Mark had dated Michelle for years, and when they broke up and he moved out, Joseph moved in. According to Mark, Michelle had suffered from depression and had taken medication on and off. After Michelle was arrested, she called Mark and demanded that he find her an attorney. The defense highlighted this as evidence of Michelle's controlling nature. His testimony was followed by Dr. Donald Dutton, who told the jury that Joseph had diminished mental capacity and was under the control of Michelle when he helped carry out the murders. He said, "He's in this protective mode and playing out this game plan, which was set up ahead of time to kill the entire family." Joseph had told Dr. Dutton that Michelle would have come after him and killed him if he tried to leave or if he did not participate in the murders. He said that Joseph had hallucinations and spirit guides and that he did not have the ability to walk away from the codependent relationship. He said that growing up, Joseph had been neglected by his mother, who he described as promiscuous and mentally ill. He said that he had very few friends and most of his relationships as an adult were online. He had diagnosed Joseph as having schizotypical and borderline personality disorders. The doctor also told the jury that Joseph had been so desperate for a relationship that on 4 different occasions, he had flown or driven to meet 4 women he had met online and sent his possessions to them beforehand. The 4th woman was Michelle. He said that as soon as Joseph moved in with Michelle, she took control of the relationship. She limited Joseph's internet access, refused to let him get a driver's license, and shamed him. According to Dr. Dutton, the relationship had all the hallmarks of an abusive relationship. And at one point, Joseph had even offered to castrate himself, after Michelle accused him of being sexist. He further testified that Michelle had kept a hit list of people who she believed that had wronged her, and that list included her family members. Michelle had allegedly made Joseph believe that she had been abused and believed that she would not be able to evolve to a new spiritual level as long as her parents were alive. During closing arguments, Prosecutor O'Toole told the jury that the rampage was well planned and clearly premeditated. He said, "A family of 30 years does not exist anymore. Not only did he provide assistance to Michelle Anderson, he fired bullets into the heads of 5 of the 6 victims." Once again, the defense reiterated their theory that Joseph had been coerced by Michelle to participate in the murders. He told the jurors, "This case is about 2 people with extreme impairments and mental illness." The jury were sent away to deliberate. They had the options to either acquit Joseph or find him guilty of first or second degree murder. After deliberating for less than 2 days, the jury reached a verdict. They found Joseph McEnroe guilty of 6 counts of first degree murder with aggravating circumstances. Joseph showed little emotion as the verdict was read out. The same jury would be deciding whether Joseph would be sentenced to death or be sentenced to life in prison without parole. The prosecution were calling for a death sentence while the defense were calling for leniency. During the sentencing phase, defense attorney Bill Prestia admitted that it was a diabolic union that had resulted in the murders. He stated, "We had what you might call a match made in hell." He said that despite the horrendous actions of Joseph, he didn't deserve to die. He said that he'd been operating with mental impairments that had made it impossible for him to see the alternatives that would be clear to other people. The prosecution would call on a number of witnesses to testify to the impact of the murders. Mary Anderson was called to testify. Up until now, she had not publicly spoken about the massacre that killed her parents, her brother, her sister-in-law, and her nephew and niece. She revealed that she was supposed to be at her parents' home that day with her 2 little boys. However, she was sick and had to cancel. She cried as she testified and told the jury, "It's destroyed us. They were my family. I miss them. We loved each other." Mary said that since the murders, she had rarely left the house and lived in fear. Linda, who found the bodies, also provided an impact statement. She said that she had to quit her job because her route took her past the Andersons' home, and it was far too difficult for her. She said, "You realize when you say goodbye to a friend, you don't know for sure that you don't know for sure that you will see them alive again." Wayne's brother, Ken, spoke about his brother, while Scott's best friend, Ryan Baker, spoke about how Scott sent him letters when he was in the Navy. He became emotional as he spoke about how Scott was a family man and how much he loved his kids. Tony Mantle, Erica's father, said that he was not the same person he was before the murders, and that he never will be. The defense team then called on Joseph to testify on his own behalf, in a bid to save his own life.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You can point the microphone, just point it right up at your mouth. I think that's going to work there.
Yeah, okay, how's that?
That's good. Can you state your name, please, and spell it for the record?
Joseph McEnroe, M-C-E.
Okay. Mr. McEnroe, where do you live?
I live at 505th Avenue, Seattle, Washington, 98104.
And And what is that facility you live in?
That is the King County Correctional Facility. That is the King County Jail.
Why are you there?
For the murders of six people.
And are you guilty of that? Is there any question that you are guilty of murder?
There is no question of that. I did do this awful thing, yes.
He said that he was terrified of taking the witness stand and was evidently heavily medicated for anxiety and depression. He appeared disconnected before appearing lucid, as he rambled and giggled throughout his testimony. It was the first time that most people had ever heard Joseph speak, and his nervousness, combined with his speech impediment, came as a surprise to many people, who had conjured him up as a murderous monster. Instead, he seemed riddled with self-doubt and emotionally damaged.
I don't know if you guys can tell, but I have a terrible voice. And, like, when we had the, my confession on the overhead or whatever, I don't know about you guys, but I was struck by how just awful my voice was. And, there's no reason I'm not very confrontational. I mean, how are you supposed to get into an argument with somebody when,
Joe, let me interrupt you for a second.
Physical awkwardness.
You have a bit of a speech impediment, is that right?
A bit of a speech impediment, yes. And I'm very shy in general anyway. And I tend to speak quickly and softly when I'm nervous. I don't do that quite as much anymore because I've really practiced on my speech pattern, on refining my speech patterns and whatnot over the past several years.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Joe. This speech impediment, how do you refer it? How do you refer to it when you're talking about?
Usually I say that I have trouble pronouncing the R sound. Not all R sounds, just the AR sound. The reason is that there's a little, I don't know exactly what the term is, but there's a little, you know that tendon right underneath your tongue, attaching your tongue to the lower palate? Mine actually comes out a little bit further than usual, and so it makes it difficult for the tongue to draw back all the way, so it makes it more of a L sound than an R sound.
Joseph was asked to explain very briefly why he had murdered the family.
I want to ask you first, very generally, why did you do that?
Mr. McEnroe, if I could ask you to push the microphone a little bit further away from me.
Yeah,
there you go.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Sorry, not very good at public speaking. The reason is I thought I had to.
Why didn't you just leave? Why didn't you...
I would have. If it was left to me, I absolutely would have. I wanted to just leave. I mean, I'm not a confrontational person. I don't like hurting people or fighting or even arguing. I just don't. And I would have, if it had been up to me, I would have just left.
You don't like hurting people, but you killed or helped kill six people, right?
Yeah, I did. I didn't want to, but I did. Because I thought I had to.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
I'm sorry, I did because I thought I had to. And yeah, I know that's not a very good excuse, but I'm not trying to excuse myself. I'm just trying to explain my actions.
Joseph spent several hours on the stand detailing his troubled childhood. He spoke about several suicide attempts he had made, as well as the abuse that had been inflicted on him by his mother's numerous boyfriends. He spoke about spirit animals which would appear to him in the form of a crow, and spoke about how he met Michelle.
I met her online. We were part of a writing group, and yeah.
When was this that you met Michelle?
I met her in, I'd say, 2000. One, two, three at the latest. I don't know, very early in the teens.
In the teens?
Aughts.
The aughts?
Aughts,
like
whatever.
After the year 2000?
After the year 2000.
Joe, where were you living at the time?
I was living at the time in North Carolina.
What's
Fayetteville?
That?
Fayetteville.
Fayetteville, North
yeah,
Carolina.
North Carolina. Beautiful place. You get a chance to go there? You okay. know, you really should. It's very wet, though.
Okay. Now, tell us, you met Michelle in this online group, is that right?
Yes, we were both part of this online group. I'd actually been, because this was one of my, it was basically a meritocracy where the more effort that you...
Meritocracy,
yes. Where it was based off of how many characters you had playing and being involved in the storylines and the how good of stories you come up with and stuff like that, right? So somebody who spends a lot of time on there and doing a lot of stories and coming up with a lot of good writing would be considered relatively high rank, though basically everybody was equal in all reality.
When speaking about his victims, he said, "I've taken their futures and what they might have been. I've also taken them from these people who had done nothing but show me kindness and goodness." He said that he killed Nathan and Olivia because he had just killed their parents and wanted to save them from a life of hell. He said that when he killed them, he believed that they would be reincarnated. Joseph claimed that Michelle had become obsessed with killing her family and said that if they killed them, it would show the world that people shouldn't mess with her. He said that he tried to convince Michelle against killing her family until finally giving in and trusting that killing her family would end their problems.
During those 4 weeks, we were going over it again and again. Just, I'd want to go off and run. I wanted to run. I'm like, look, if we're in this danger, let's get the hell out of here, right? She's like, no, I can't do that. I have to do this. I'm not going to let these people just push me around and do whatever they feel like.
You gotta slow down.
I'm sorry. She's like, look, I'm not going to just let these people push me around and do whatever they feel like. I have to do this. By this point, I had just really given up myself, actually. She tried to turn me into an attack dog, and so she had.
She what?
She tried to turn me into an attack dog. She'd spent all this time going, stripping away my personality, and so it worked.
Spent all this time?
Stripping away my personality and replacing with one that worked better for what she wanted. So, there you go. And so when it came down to it, just don't ask questions, just do what I say.
Joseph went on to first of all describe the murders of Wayne and Judy in explicit detail.
So I see him charging at her. I pull my gun and I fire, right? At this point, he's actually right beside the far end of the table. I'm at the south corner of the table, basically. So I shoot at him. Because he was running, he flies to the side and knocks into the table and the chairs, sending them falling, sprawling, whatever.
Some of the dining room chairs?
Yeah. He falls down, he lands on the ground. His head is right by where the corner of the thing is.
So after you shot Wayne, what happened next?
After I shot Wayne, I turned immediately to my right, and there was Judy, and I fired on her. I turned immediately to my right, and that was Judy. She flinched. She was right over by the sink, and I was still in that passageway right there. I only remember actually firing once. Apparently, I fired twice. The second one hit her and sent her collapsing beside the fridge. Collapsing in front of the fridge. I remember the last thing she said was, "No, no!" And then she wasn't moving anymore, and so I went over by where she was, and I told her that I was sorry, and I shot her in the head. The way that you saw her in the autopsy pictures was not the way that I had left her.
I'm sorry.
The way that you had seen her in the autopsy pictures was the look on her face was not how I had left her.
What Well, you left your dad, so...
I'm saying that her expression changed. She did not have that expression when I killed her.
Joseph then went on to describe moving Judy's body from where she had been killed, and he begins to break down in tears. He wraps his arms around his head and begins to jerk around on the witness stand.
So I moved it. So I went and moved Judy first. I put a bag over her head because I couldn't look at her. Because of, see, the emptiness, well, she should be. So... So I moved her out the back door, and it's...
Get yourself a tissue, take a second.
Under cross-examination, the prosecution pointed out that during Joseph's original interview with police, his voice appeared much deeper and stronger. However, during the trial, his voice was extremely high-pitched and much softer. According to Joseph, he had been working on his voice because he wanted to have a voice that came across as more pleasant. During the tense questioning, his voice was much more clear and easier to understand. Joseph also seemingly had a twitch which no witness had testified about before. He claimed that he twitched when he was nervous, and when questioned, he became frustrated and said, "What I'm trying to say is that, you know what, fuck it. If you want to kill me, go ahead." It was now up to the jury to decide Joseph's fate. Unlike the criminal trial, when the jurors needed to be unanimous in their verdict, in the penalty phase, only one juror had to vote for life for Joseph to be saved from a death sentence. The jury deliberated for a week before sentencing Joseph to life in prison. They had been unable to reach a unanimous decision. When he was being formally sentenced, Judge Ramstall placed 6 carnations and placards in the courtroom gallery, representing the 6 victims. He said, "That empty bench and those 6 carnations symbolize the lives you've taken. The horrible fate that befell them should never have fallen on any human being." Shortly thereafter, Prosecutor Satterberg announced that he would no longer be seeking the death penalty against Michelle. Her trial began in January of 2016. During opening statements, Prosecutor O'Toole told the jury that in her first interview, Michelle mentioned money more than 35 times. When explaining why she killed her family, she had told investigators she killed her brother because he owed her money, and killed her parents because they wanted her to pay rent and pay for her own car insurance. Her defense decided against providing an opening statement. The evidence during Michelle's trial was essentially the same evidence as Joseph's trial. Michelle decided against testifying. Her defense attorney, Colleen O'Connor, tried to argue that Michelle was in a crazy and delusional state of mind when the murders occurred. She said that Michelle suffered from depression and anxiety and was extremely paranoid. She suggested that at most, Michelle should have been charged with second-degree murder. During her defense's closing argument, Michelle burst into tears and started to loudly blow her nose. On rebuttal, Prosecutor O'Toole said that Michelle was self-centered and narcissistic, and that she had never been diagnosed with depression or anxiety. Michelle didn't testify, and her defense team called no witnesses. Michelle Anderson would be found guilty of 6 counts of first-degree murder. She, too, was sentenced to life in prison.
Michelle...
I want you to know that we loved you so much. You know the truth. It destroyed me. And look what you've done to your life. You care. What you did to our family. Your brother loved you so much. You'll have a lot of time to think about it. And I don't know, I'm done with you. It kills me. I loved you so much. So one day, I suggest you learn about our Lord Jesus. Yeah. Because we all go. And I know. I don't know where you'll go. I know where I'm going to go. And I'll be with them.
The scene at the Andersons' Carnation home on the 24th of December 2007 looked like any regular Christmas Eve. Judy Anderson was wrapping presents, while Wayne Anderson was watching television. As they were waiting on the rest of their family to come over and celebrate the festivities, they had no idea that their other daughter, Michelle Anderson, and her boyfriend, Joseph McEnroe, were loading their weapons, preparing to exact revenge for perceived mistreatment. In less than 2 hours, they snuffed out 3 generations of one family, simply because of greed. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said it at the start, but once again, a massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters. Morbidology is a one-woman team, and the support goes such a long way. It helps defray the cost of freedom of information requests, hosting, subscriptions, and much more. So please feel free to check it out if you'd like to support the show in return for some awesome stuff. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, followed me on social media. All of the support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Military Murder. Until next time, take care of yourselves, have an amazing festive period with your loved ones, and stay safe.
You may have been watching the news and keeping an eye on the Vanessa Guillen case out of Fort Hood, Texas. Well, Military Murder is a podcast about cases just like this. Murders that occur around the world at the hands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and sometimes even veterans. In addition to extensive coverage of the Vanessa Guillen case, Military Murder recently featured an unsolved murder case out of North Carolina. Get this. During Memorial Day weekend this year, 8 soldiers went camping, but only 7 returned home. The 8th soldier's partial remains washed ashore 6 days later, and his death was ruled a homicide. The case involves a sketchy 911 call with conflicting information by the friends and a $25,000 reward offered by Army investigators looking for the public's help. New episodes of Military Murder are available every Monday wherever you listen to podcasts. And with a backlog of 40 episodes, there is plenty of content for you to binge. Now go on, subscribe and listen to Military Murder.